I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. As the marathon American election campaign enters its final stages, the rest of the world is paying close attention. The contest has become one between a highly experienced political operator in Hillary Clinton and a freewheeling, unpredictable outsider in Donald Trump. Today, we're joined by well-known Australian writer Don Watson, who recently spent time in the US and has written a quarterly essay about his observations. Don Watson, tell us something of the background to this essay.
Well, I agreed to write it last year sometime, thinking it would be a kind of sequel to an essay on the United States and America I wrote 10 or 12 years ago, called Rabbit Syndrome, a very early quarterly essay. It turned out a bit different to that, because it was such an unusual election, and it was more interesting than the relationship between Australia and the United States. So it's a sort of standalone thing on the election at a certain stage. And I decided that instead of going to some unlikely place, some down-at-heel rust belt city or somewhere down south or whatever, I'd go to the heartland. So I chose a state which I've always thought was one of the more reasonable places in America, Wisconsin. And I went out there and discovered that it's become as unreasonable as all the rest of the United States, at least that part between the Rockies and the Appalachians. In that it has at its heart a continuing progressive city in Madison, the capital, one of the more progressive cities in the United States, and one in which you think you can't help wandering around wondering why there aren't more cities like this in such a wealthy country built on the principles of the Enlightenment, allegedly. But venture out of Madison and you're in what's become increasingly the home of the evangelical right. You're in the land of its governor. It's Republican Governor Scott Walker, who's a brutal example of Republican politics over the last 25 years. Or if you go to Milwaukee, you'll find a city divided between a predominantly African-American impoverished center, which one of the poorest cities in the United States now, with the highest rates of incarceration and the usual consequences of impoverishment and segregation. And then as you drive out of Milwaukee, you cross an invisible line into the tightest Republican voting bloc in the US. So I found in Wisconsin many of the underlying themes of this election. And that sort of gothic quality of the United States, where everything has a very deep and often dark story behind it. Although in the case of Wisconsin, it's gone from being... Well, I'll give you an example. In 1928, of 130 members of the Wisconsin legislature, only 10 didn't describe themselves as progressive. It was a state built around a university and a dairy farming community, largely. It was a common sense Yankee state, and it's now a deeply divided, rather difficult place.
Did people explain to you why the country has become so fractured and why there's more fear than apparently in the past?
Yes, some did. I had some very good conversations in Wisconsin, particularly in Madison, and with the mayor, a man called Paul Soglin. Here's my grand theory of U.S. history. Right at the beginning, the United States, the founders knew that the republic, the success of a democratic republic, depended on people having a share of property. That's the thing that Tocqueville and others have written about over and over again. If you didn't have property, if you didn't have the expansion of wealth, the expansion of frontiers, then it wouldn't work. It just wouldn't work. So they expanded west, and then they kept expanding west in the Pacific, the Munro Doctrine, all the rest of that. And if you look at American history, you sometimes think whether it's the expansion into the grasslands of Wisconsin or the expansion that came with the tech boom of the 90s or whatever boom there has been, American democracy flourishes because people have a stake. But then it falls back. And at the moment, it's fallen right back. And it's now an economy which is less equal than it was even at the height of the Gilded Age. The figures are simply outrageous. 1% of the population owning 40% of the wealth, 10% of the population owning 75% of the wealth. 3/4 of all the new wealth created since the great financial crisis has gone to 1% of the population. Democracy isn't sustainable in that sort of circumstance. And while you might think, you know, you would think, well, then Bernie Sanders or some kind of socialistic populism might arise. We also know from experience that at times like this, you get the other kind, which is the Trump kind, which I think fills most of the criteria by which we decide something is fascist.
So do you think that the problems of inequality and the other difficulties that we're seeing coming through in American society could be a model for what we eventually get in Australia? Or do you think that the two societies are so different that there's not that danger?
I think they're very, I think they, I mean, they are obviously very different. You know, both are federations, and so they're rather difficult to govern. They have both have, you know, the difficulties of a federal system. I think that, I'd only go this far, that what is happening in the United States now has something to do with the religion of neoliberalism and the really nasty tactics of the Republican Party since Reagan. And we ought to be careful, I think, that we don't go the same way. Certainly inequality is increasing here, and we have seen the revival of Hansenism, and we know that Australia is prone to bouts of xenophobia and even of racism. But I don't think there's the historical background in Australia that is in America. A lot of these contests in America go way, way back. They go back to they've never been resolved. They weren't, the Civil War didn't resolve the problems of race in America. For that matter, the problem of a republic and an empire has never been resolved. Can a republic be an empire? America's, apart from Teddy Roosevelt, America's been in denial about its imperial nature for most of its life. And the Rust Belt problem, you know, predates the great financial crisis. I mean, these go back to the 1960s. You know, there are cities in America where, with half the population they once had, they were the model cities of the United States in the 50s and 60s, and now they're the models of collapse.
So do you see a serious parallel between the Trump movement and the Hansen movement?
Not really. I mean, no, I don't. I think there's just a... I find it hard to imagine that in an equivalent primary system in Australia that Hansen could garner anything close to the votes, the overwhelming votes that Trump won with a really brutal campaign.
Not in size, but in what these movements reflect.
I think it's similar, but different. I feel like I know less about where Hansen is drawing her votes from now than I know about Trump. But I don't know. I mean, I think you could imagine that Australia would be, you know, among the more moderate states of the US if we were indeed a state.
And will remain so.
Yeah, we're probably sort of Colorado. I don't know why I think Colorado, but Colorado's got everything.
Now, it's far enough out from the election to take a bit of a punt, so who do you think will win?
I still think that Hillary will probably win, but as a person who never takes short odds, I'd have a saver on Trump. I think he is frighteningly close to winning. even my dyed-in-the-wool Hillaryites in the United States, you know, good Californian and New York liberals, are nervous about the debates and just what he might do to her. I think everyone remembers saying he has no hope in the Republican primaries, and then he just brutally won them by a huge margin. No one's ever done it before.
Probably a lesson to journalists in prediction.
Well, to everyone.
All
in
the dangers of.
Exactly, yeah.
So, of course, we've now got this latest scare about Hillary Clinton's health. To what extent do you think that's going to be a serious issue, a setback for her?
Well, it's one of the frightening things. I mean, I don't know. I saw that vision of her stumbling as she got into the car, being half carried into the car, and thought, is this the terrible moment that we're going to remember forever and ever? That it was at this point that Trump's ascension became a sort of inevitability. The fact that he's been playing on her ill health for a fortnight or 3 weeks is even more concerning, that somehow he knows something about it. I don't know what, you know, I do find, because the hideous thing about it is it's as if, I'm sure he hasn't, but it's as if he has brutalised her as well, you know, that he's, I can't imagine how you would debate such a man. And the thing about Hillary Clinton is that she's magnificent when she's in her lower register explaining, calling on her great knowledge and intelligence and genuine decency. But once she hits an upper register, she's not a natural politician anymore.
And an upper register meaning?
Or when she gets excited, when she gets angry, or when she even gets exultant.
Like her recent denouncing of a lot of Trump supporters, you mean?
Yeah, that was a bad move. That was a terrible move, I think. Because the people think that Trump supporters are somehow finite and definable. I don't think they are. I think there's a great middle there, including some sort of diehards from the Sanders campaign who probably may go across to Trump. It's hard to imagine, but just might, in a kind of worse the better sort of idea.
She does seem quite unpopular among a lot of people who wouldn't be particularly alienated from her political views.
Yeah, well, she's been around too long. There's that, and I think there are a lot of people who feel...
The family business.
The family business is not pretty. I mean, I think, you know, Democrats should ask themselves, what would they be doing if the Republican candidate, not Trump, but if it were Romney or McCain or someone, had made $153 million out of speech-making in the last decade and a half and $1.2 million out of four speeches to Wall Street, and the emails and the rest? It's not, you know, she's not... I think she's the one candidate that Trump could beat. That's the worry, because of her record and because of... You know, I think when people think of Bill and Hillary back in the White House, they feel like they've been cheated. You know, that this isn't democracy. This is a dynasty. This is entitlement.
It's interesting too, isn't it, that you've got a contest between two older candidates, much older than, for example, the recent leaders we've seen in Australia. One, I think, 68, the other 70. Bernie Sanders was older still. Do you think that... candidates of this age would simply never be acceptable today in Australia, in modern Australia?
Yeah, it's a curious thing. I don't know why. And the oldest of them was the one who was most popular with the young. You know, Bernie, they were...
Well, he was recycling the 70s.
They loved him. Well, he wasn't... Not for them was he recycling it. He was brand new to them. They hadn't heard anyone say these things. I thought Sanders' campaign was brilliant, mainly because it was simply concrete. He just kept saying, these are the figures, this is no good. And Hillary sounded tired by comparison, you know, platitudinous even, and Trump was Trump. I don't know why we keep going for these young people. I mean, I suppose Malcolm's in his early 60s. It's worrying, though, when you feel 25 years, we know you're 25 years older than the Prime Minister. It's never happened to me before.
It has to catch up with you.
I'd like them a bit older than they are.
If Trump did win, what do you think the consequences would be internationally and for Australia in particular, for our region in particular?
I can't imagine. I think it's impossible to know what Trump would do.
Some say, well, advisers would be put in to restrain him. Do you think that's true?
I guess so. And it's hard to imagine just how a Trump presidency would work, but no doubt he would find advisers. I think, you know, Hillary's foreign policy is worrying for Australia and for the rest of the world, frankly. I think she's an inveterate hawk and is unlikely to change her tune. She may change socially. Her social policy may be much improved by the Sanders factor. But she'll be limited because they won't get the House. They might get the Senate. They're going to be, you know, they might get 2 years to do something, and after that it'll be the same old routine. But Trump, I don't know. I don't think that everything he says is mad. He just says it, even if he's saying something sane, he says it in a mad way. Like if he's talking about Russia and Putin, and I don't think American policy towards Russia's been all that clever. But I don't think that Trump is going to be the man to really fix it. I have no idea. I mean, when you think of a world governed by Trump and North Korea and Putin, my God, it's too horrible to think.
Interesting times in the Chinese sense.
Very much so.
Don Watson, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast. The bells you've been hearing ringing in the background are because we're talking today in Parliament House, and the houses are sitting. Thank you to my producer, Pat Hutchins. We'll be back with another interview soon. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.